Hello everyone and welcome to this podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Dr. Sakina Bakare and I am an anaesthetic and intensive care trainee in London. I have just been chairing a session at the Updates today with three of my colleagues who are here in person. The point of this podcast today is to talk about some of the issues we raised at the session. And for those who haven't got the Updates program in front of them, the session was on day two, to grow and thrive, and it was looking at the journeys of some of our accomplished Black anaesthetists and intensivists in the UK. And so I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
Hello, my name is Dr. Sathina Watson. I am an anaesthetist in training. I am an ST7 currently, about to CCT, and I'm based in the southwest of England.
Hello everyone, my name is Daniel Olaya. I'm a CT3 based at the Royal Free Barnet Hospital.
Hi everyone, my name is Dr. Desire Onwoche and I'm a consultant anaesthetist at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital.
Thank you for introducing yourself. So the session to grow and thrive was looking at what the journeys of some of my colleagues have been, what inspired them, what their aspirations were, and just telling us how they achieved what they achieved and hopefully inspiring a new generation coming through. During that session, I highlighted the underrepresentation of people who identify as Black in anaesthetics and intensive care. And what we would like to do as a part of this podcast is talk about what we think the solutions are, how you, in your sphere of influence, can make a difference, and how we can move those numbers from 1.5%, hopefully, maybe even triple those numbers, so they're on par with what the percentage of doctors are, Black doctors are in the UK at present.
Well, what I wanted to say about the session, both participating and listening, was in fact how profoundly moving it was and how hearing everyone's stories is very unique, but it's also very sort of validating, and it was a real celebration of how much effort goes into becoming a doctor in the first place and choosing a career in anaesthesia or intensive care medicine and what it takes to get through that. And I was particularly struck by a lot of what Desire had said about, I can't remember, you said you had to do however many airways and you said, I'm going to double that. I've got to do this many publications. I'm going to double that. And that really struck a chord with me, and with how hard you have to work, you have to go over and above. And that's what I felt.
Thanks for that. Just to touch on that, I was always taught that because of my skin colour, I do have to work harder in order to get the same outcomes as someone who's not Black. So just in reference to what you were saying, we were told during my airway fellowship, 20 to 30 await fibroptics. I did 73. No one has even come close to that yet. In my obstetric fellowship in Toronto, I was told do one publication. I did three because I wanted to achieve more. And I think it touches a bit on the whole burnout thing as well. I think in my mind, I've just always had to work that hard. So it's almost the norm for me. But I'm now about to go on maternity leave and I've realised there's a lot of work I need to hand over to other colleagues, and I didn't realise how much work I actually do to the point where I actually can't hand over all of this to one person.
Wow.
So how on earth was I doing it all? And this has allowed me, I think, to reflect a little bit on how much work I'm actually doing. And maybe, you know, when I was a little bit younger, it wouldn't have mattered, but as I'm getting older, I think I do have to reassess the amount of stuff that I do take on, because I still do feel like I have to prove myself. It hasn't gone away.
Do you think that your work is visible? Do you think that people know that you're doing it?
No way. Maybe a few select people know, but not everyone knows. I speak at quite a few international conferences and loads of people still don't know. And I'm not the kind of person that is just going to go around shouting it, you know, or tooting my own horn. But I think that within my small niche, I'm trying to make a difference, and I'm trying to make myself visible within that niche. I don't necessarily need everybody to know or to congratulate me on it. This is my own personal achievements. What I'm striving for is all personal aspirations.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you, Desire. I think, I mean, everyone else who's here as well, and those who are not able to join us, who are also speaking, so Dr. Olusoya and Rochelle as well, both sort of alluded to similar things. And there was something that Desire said when she, in her talk, which was being a Black woman is like being Black twice. And that really hit home for me. And I had to evaluate as well. So how have I tried to counteract that? And, you know, Desire just sort of said how she tries to counteract it. And then she touched on the subject of burnout, and obviously that's a big thing now within medicine, and to throw in that resilience. So how do we, as we've all been told we're role models, but as role models we're doing a lot, and we're doing a lot more to be able to be seen. So Sathina has multiple hats, she's whereas Daniel has multiple hats. Everyone here has multiple hats. I've got multiple hats I wear. How do you balance that? How do you have a work-life balance? How do you relax? Do you ever relax? And I can say personally, I felt like I can't stop. You know, if I chill, I'll say this, if I go off sick, will they think I'm actually sick, or will they think I'm just, you know, flaky? But the thing is, and there is data out there that shows that there is, quote unquote, this black burnout, where particularly in the States, where some of the residents and some of the consultants, there was a particular story, and sorry, I can't remember the paper now, the article, but he talked about being in his 50s and having to stop work, and he had an episode of depression and he couldn't go back to work, and it was something benign, but it was as a result of just how much work he was doing beforehand, you know, being number one. And that made me reflect, and just like Desire just said, you know, you get to a point where you reflect and think, okay, I need to look after myself, because we are in our role as role models. Not only do we want to encourage people to come into anesthesia, but we want them to do it in a balanced way. We want them to have the benefits of being an anesthetist, you know, that work-life balance. How do you do that, and how do you protect yourself?
It's not easy, to be honest, to think about yourself in a way. So yes, you have your own dreams, you have your own aspirations, your own goals that you're trying to attain. But for me personally, I also have in the back of my mind, there are trainees coming up after me, there are medical students coming up after me who are like me, who want to see that it's possible to achieve these things. So in the back of my mind, I'm not only doing it for myself, I'm doing it to be an example to others or to inspire others. And I think that's what makes me do more, even though I don't need to do more. So when I was a trainee and I did my fellowship in Canada, I was doing research and publications because I wanted to boost my CV for a consultant job. And my intention was to just stop all of that as soon as I got my consultant job. But that hasn't happened. I've just been doing more and more and more. And actually, I found that I've been able to bring on other people onto projects. So other black colleagues onto projects, other trainees onto projects. And if I wasn't still doing that, I wouldn't be able to create those opportunities for others. So I think that does play into the fact that I don't feel like I should stop because I'm still helping other people. Trying to have a good work-life balance is definitely difficult, but I do think anesthesia as a specialty lends itself well to that kind of lifestyle. So my full-time job, I only work 3 days a week. That's full-time as an anesthetist, which a lot of other specialties can't say they do. So I do have 2 days a week where I can choose either to do private work, I can do nothing at all, I can do research. So I try to stick to that model and not overwork, so that I do always have time to myself. I want at least one lie-in during the week where I don't have to wake up early. And I think that's helped. And especially since COVID, that's become more of a point for me to do every week. And I think that's definitely helped, just to maintain that sense of stability.
Burnout is it's an interesting topic, isn't it? And it's the first time I've heard that phrase, black burnout. Everyone can suffer from burnout, and it's not something unique to us, but hearing black burnout is a very interesting point. What I would reflect on about that in our experience as black people doing anesthetics, and particularly me in the middle of my training, it's that I think for me, I always try to remember there's certain things which are very important, which I need to prioritize. And being less than full-time is a great option, which is a new thing. It's a positive thing which many people are taking advantage of, allowing them to avoid burnout and allowing them to try to be more healthy at the same time as striving and aspiring towards their goals in this career that we have. So I think it's a positive conversation that we're having, and I think things are being done. But of course, yeah, there are still some disparities, and this is part of the conversation that we're having now. So I think it's a positive one.
I've also not heard of the phrase black burnout before, so that's very interesting. But I would say, I think that part of it, the system, is that we do have to do those things. And you can be doing all those things and just be seen as adequate. Mm-hmm. So if you stopped doing those things, then what? Very, very complicated is what I would say. And I think I've been told to, you know, consider doing less. And at the time, I wasn't actually doing that much. But I wanted to say, but you don't understand. I have to do these things because I'm not seen in the same light as other people. So there's that. And then coming to how to stop burnout, what I do is I keep track of the projects that I'm doing, and I know in my head roughly what deadlines and when things are due and whether I've got family time or holidays or whatever it might be. And so I consider that when I'm asked to do things. And what I've got really good at doing is saying no to things, and which people don't believe me. I say no to probably 70% of the stuff that I'm asked to do, which means that the stuff that I've picked to do is something that I really want to do. But what I've started doing when I've said no, which is what Desire said, but I know someone else that might be interested in doing that, and trying to share it out and give other people opportunities. And that's other races or genders. So that's what I've been doing. And I think that that's why today is really important, is that this college event has given people a chance to speak that might not have had that chance before. So as we go along, we need to basically bring everyone into the party, because everyone's got a story. Everyone's got such interesting things that they do. And that thing about imposter syndrome, every single person has got something to share and to contribute. And frankly, after today, I'm really excited to see what's going to happen with you guys, with your careers and where you're going to go. And I think that's a great thing.
Wow, thanks guys. Yeah, I must say I was like putting this day together, and when it came up, it was like, how is it going to work, you know? And but throughout the whole process of organization, it was all about stories, because I think stories are really powerful, and the lived experience is what gives you something to base your, you know, whatever change you want to put in place. It's nice to say, okay, Dr. X had this experience and this is what helped in their journey, and that's really powerful. And just as the same as we'd go to conferences and hear patients speak about their experience of awareness and under anesthesia, or just their experience of sort of like how, you know, having a relative die, you know, how that changes our practice is so powerful. And so some of the questions that were asked today were just gives everyone like a pause to sort of reflect and think about how I can change within my sphere of influence. And I go on about that because it's what you can do in your sphere of influence. And so if we talk about what we said, so there's been lots and lots of reports. I mean, there is probably at least three GMC related ones I can think about off the top of my head. There's the BMA report on racism. There's the differential attainment reports. There's numerous reports from numerous NHS organisations, and there are numerous NHS organisations involved healthcare disparities and differential attainment and disparity in healthcare outcomes for people of colour. What can we do? Or what do you think our colleagues should be doing to help? So if we just take the problem of differential attainment, and that's from coming in specialty, exams and ARCPs. If we just take that sort of topic, because it's a huge topic, what do you think should be happening in our local hospitals, in our deaneries or HEE, in our areas? What should be happening that isn't happening at the moment?
So I think this is a really interesting question, and I'm really glad you asked it, and for us to reflect on. And I challenge myself to really think, okay, we're having this nice discussion, we're talking about race and, you know, people getting together and supporting people, but what am I actually going to do? What are my colleagues actually going to do? And it made me think about the Embrace report. Black women are 4 times more likely to die during childbirth. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I thought, okay, I'm on call. I'm doing OBS. I like OBS, but things can get hairy sometimes. When I've got a black woman in front of me, if I think she's 4 times more likely to die, I'm going to behave different. Maybe I'm going to call my consultant a little bit earlier. Maybe I'm going to think about something a little bit earlier. Maybe I'm just going to have that extra feeling and atmosphere of caution, because it deserves it, because of the data, because of what we've seen. So if I now extrapolate that into the situation now with exams or support or black colleagues, myself, I think what that means is in those personal situations that people may find themselves in, when they can see perhaps, you know, they have a black anaesthetist who may benefit from something. If you think about the data, if you think about the numbers, we like numbers, don't we like data? We've got the data now. We've got it. So what that means is, yeah, maybe they could use a bit more support. Maybe I can chat to them. Maybe I can ask them, is everything going okay? Do you feel any challenges because of the color of your skin? Because you're not talking about this off your own mind. There's data that's been published. So therefore, I think there's something to stand upon and to say, actually, I'm going to do something because of. And I think thinking about the Embrace report and how we respond to obstetric as an anesthesia is a good place to start.
I would say, as well as data, there's stuff that's unmeasured and much more difficult to quantify, and that is the microaggressions that go on constantly every single day that even become, I will normalise them, you know, you just accept them. And I think colleagues of any race, it's very hard to explain, is to not make an assumption that someone, how you prepared for something or how you might deal with something is the same. It might be different for the other person. And there's been some good examples from people in this table where they've experienced a microaggression and someone has stepped in and challenged that, which can be extremely powerful. And not only are you showing the person that has experienced that microaggression or overt racism or whatever, that you validate what they've gone through. You're showing other people in the room, this isn't acceptable and this is how you can approach it and this is how you can deal with it. And tools like active bystander training, and there are loads of free educational things from HEE on understanding IMG graduates. There's loads of stuff out there that will give you the tools. Help.
I think that's a really important point that you make, is that I often get asked by non-black colleagues, you know, what is it they can do to help? How can they actually make a difference? Because, you know, like I said in the session, they don't see themselves as racist, you know, and that's true for the majority of them. But actually, you need to be anti-racist in order to help. You need to actually actively speak up when you see racism. Even if you don't feel comfortable to speak up when you see racism, like I explained in the session, just having someone, you know, take you aside and say, I saw what happened, I'm really sorry, I felt it too, I know it's inappropriate. It lets me know as a black person that it's not in my head, I'm not alone, that people who are not black can also see this is happening. And that really does, you cannot underestimate the value of that that kind of conversation, that kind of support from non-black colleagues. So I think that's something that we can focus on more in terms of encouraging people how to be allies, quote unquote allies. And just to throw it back to the differential attainment question. So I'm helping a college at the moment with a differential attainment masterclass. So the idea behind it is that anyone who is from a disadvantaged group and has been struggling to pass the exams are prioritised to enter this masterclass, which is a day online of focused Viva training. But the focus is more on the non-clinical, non-verbal type of ways of communicating that maybe if you weren't raised in the UK or you didn't go to medical school here, you might not know about things that actually help you pass the exam just because of how you come across and how you speak. So this all kind of started because the Royal College of Psychiatrists did a similar thing where they showed that actually by running these masterclasses, they improved the exam pass rate for these disadvantaged groups. And this is something we're now trying to replicate with the Royal College. And it just started end of last year. We're about to do the third session next month. And our plan is once we've done a full year, we see what the exam results are like for those who attended the masterclass and if it has made a difference. And the challenge that you have here is that obviously you don't want to offend people or, you know, be accused of showing favoritism to one particular group. But it's like that cartoon that I showed in my talk. Actually, everyone needs a different platform. And if you're already from a disadvantaged group, you need extra platforms just to level the playing field. So we prioritize people who haven't passed the exam, who are international medical graduates, who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And then once we have that capacity, if there's any extra space, then anyone else can join. But I think because the Royal College is taking that on, it then spreads out to other hospitals, trusts, deaneries. And hopefully this is something that will become more, even more vocal in future. And maybe locally in, you know, training hospitals or wherever, there'll be similar programs or similar ways to improve things for disadvantaged people in the long run.
Thank you.
That sounds incredible. I didn't know that was happening. That sounds incredible. I'm going to find out a lot more about that. What springs to mind as you talk is, why should people care about this who are not from these backgrounds? I think they should care because they're anaesthetists and they enjoy anaesthetics and they want people to have good anaesthetics. So diversity is a good thing for anaesthetics on the whole because it provides better outcomes for the patients. Mm. So if you want better outcomes for the patients, diversity is good.
Thanks, Daniel. I think it's interesting you talked about what the college is doing. And so one of my other hats is as an educator, because I think every doctor is an educator. From the moment you're in medical school, when you're teaching your junior colleagues to when you go into you go into F1 and you're teaching the medical students, this is something we do. And some people are good at it and some people have to be trained in teaching. But one of the things that we do locally is we run, most regions have their, final Viva course that's run by the deanery. And some of it you have to pay for, some of it's free. And one of the things I've started doing recently is having one-to-one sessions with people who might have struggled with the exams in the past, or people who just need a bit more propping up, basically telling them that, you can do this, you're good enough, but they just need that one-to-one session. And it sounds like, but one thing I realize is for these things to kind of spread across the country, because you want it to spread like wildfire, you want good practice to spread like wildfire. And the GMC actually gets a lot of flack, but one thing they did say in that differential attainment report is one of the ways that we can reduce differential attainment is by spreading evidence of good practice. So by the college taking the lead in something that's worked in another college, by the Royal College of Psychiatry sharing this evidence of good practice with the Royal College of Anaesthetists, and at national level, the College of Anaesthetists is sort of taking this on. And then that will just spread down and it will become the norm. And what we're trying to do is normalizing good practice. And why should we care? Because if you can look after the most disadvantaged person in the room, everyone else will benefit. What we're saying is we're going to create an environment that makes someone who is struggling really happy and allows them to flourish. How is everybody else not going to flourish? It's just impossible not to flourish. And we look at some of these bigger tech companies and, what they have. I mean, some people, you put them in the middle of nowhere, they will survive. Some people need to have a bit more tools under their belt to survive. What you're doing is providing a slightly more comfortable environment for someone who would struggle. The person who was going to struggle, who wasn't going to struggle, is going to have a good time. And that's all we're doing. And I think, I don't know whether it's sort of a thing in medicine where we don't have to suffer. We really, really do not. And I guess we can learn from the tech environment. I mean, they achieve things that we could never think they would achieve. And they're all having lovely meals and sitting in comfortable chairs and working from home. And I'm not saying that we should all sit in comfortable chairs and work from home. It wouldn't work in our I shouldn't say this, because I'm sure someone will play this back in 50 years and show us giving anesthetics from home. But the whole idea is that we have nothing to lose and everything to gain by looking after the most disadvantaged person in the room. And then what happens is you then have people becoming the best version of themselves, and their outcomes are better, the patient outcomes are better. And all you have to do is look at the trusts that are doing really well. What do all the trusts that are doing really well, having good outcomes, what do they all have in common? They've got happy staff who feel like they belong and who feel like they're given everything they need to be the best version of themselves.
I was going to say, so Roger Klein has done a lot of work on this and has shown that diverse workforce within healthcare, you have higher CQC ratings, lower infection control issues, you have less absenteeism. There is a huge long list of positive attributes that, if you want to look at it from an economical and financial and workforce point of view, diversity improves all of those things.
Wow.
And patient outcomes, actually.
And patient outcomes.
Yeah. Everybody wins.
Yeah.
It's like the business case for diversity. It's going to be profitable, always going to be profitable.
And I think we benefit from living in this time right now where nobody can deny racism. Nobody can deny that there's prejudice going on. So even if you are the most privileged, middle-class white guy on the planet, that this is an issue. Whether or not it affects you is irrelevant. So actually, now is the time to really foster change, to really encourage people to get involved, because everyone knows it's a world issue.
Can I ask you a question, even though I'm not sharing? So something that came out, and this came out after George Floyd, and some people went and said, oh, but anaesthesia, we are an inclusive specialty. What would you say about that?
The data doesn't agree. This is really interesting, because I remember, I think it was Adrian Wong and Segs writing an article in the Bulletin, and this was my first stick in my head, as you said, out of the sand, where I responded to that, and Helgi, I think, was editor of the Bulletin, and he obviously had to approve it for it to be published. And I remember saying, I came into anaesthesia because I felt it was a very welcoming and diverse specialty. I like to think of us as leaders, we are leaders. We start off, less than full-time working, inclusivity, sustainability, we're always at the forefront. And all of us in this room came into anaesthesia because we want to be part of that group. But one thing that I cannot deny is the fact that there's just not enough black people in anaesthesia, and the numbers don't lie, like you said. Yes, we are a diverse specialty, and I think part of the problem why we probably didn't notice it as much, or we didn't talk about it as much, is because of the way we separate people who are white and people who are not white. If you group a whole bunch of people together who are not white, and the GMC report talks about this, is particularly with black, saying a whole bunch of people are black, is it's very difficult to do that because, I mean, even on the stage, you could tell how many Nigerians were there, okay? And so even within the black community, there are disparities. There are people of Caribbean background do less well than people of, I'm going to say, Nigerian background or African background. And that is something that needs to be looked into. So the sort of interventions that you would have to put in place for people who are African might be slightly different from people who are Caribbean. You might need to put a lot more effort into gaining trust, into outreach programs, into supporting someone who's of a Caribbean background compared to someone who's of a Nigerian background. And those are the things that I think that we need to look into. And that's why I've started talking about confidence in our diversity. Yes, we are a diverse specialty on in many fronts, and we are working towards it, but we need to look at what we don't, so our known unknowns. So what are we not looking at? And this is a big part of what we're not looking at, is within the diversity of our specialty, there is a group of people that are lacking or not represented that well.
So I did, nearly coming up to a couple of years ago, did a racism survey, and the results are going to come out shortly. And that was, it took a long time to analyse that because reading people's experiences of racism was very, very difficult. So it's a project that we kept putting to one side, come back to it. It confronted me with my own assumptions because we collected different backgrounds of different ethnic groups. And two groups in particular stood out to me. People that were from Arab descent and white Irish traveller community, their experience of racism, their numbers far exceeded the comments written from black and Afro-Caribbean people. So I think there are people out there from different ethnic backgrounds that actually haven't got a voice at the table, that daren't speak out about racism. So on their behalf, I think we have a responsibility to talk about everyone, really, and to not make assumptions. That's my biggest thing, is to just don't make assumption that that person standing in front of you has or hasn't had X or Y experience.
I think that's really interesting, and I think that's a really nice responsibility to take on, that, you know, actually we should all hold hands and work together with this. That's not just us, that is a systemic thing, and it's going on everywhere within medicine and anesthetics. And it reminds me of an instance when I came for a list and I was pre-assessing patients, as you do, everything was going well. I was pre-assessing this one patient for a very standard operation, and he was an Asian man, and he, after the pre-assessment, he said, "I'm really proud of you," and he shook my hand and was smiling. And I said, why are you proud of me? He said, "I'm proud of you because you're black and I haven't seen any black anesthetists." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Why do you say that? Because you're not black. Like, why do you say that?" And he said, "Well, you just don't see many, and it must have been quite hard for you." I said, "Really? You think that?" He said, "Yeah, you can see it. Like, there's really not many." I said, "Wow, I really appreciate you saying that. Thanks, and we had a good day." But I thought that was really interesting. It really, really touched me that he would go out of his way to say that, and I pressed him for more information, and he told me the truth about what he thought, and it seemed like it was a very visceral, very gut reaction for him to say that without any data, without looking at it. It was just a very raw reaction.
Just to, not to draw a negative from what you said, but how do you generally feel when people who are not black say to you, "Oh, that must have been really hard, well done"? How do you feel about that kind of comment?
I think the truth of the matter and the reality is that whatever it is what it is, and we're going to work hard and do our best and try and keep positive anyway. That's why we're here. So when they do say that, I think, where is it coming from? It's coming from usually a good place. And if it's coming from a good place, then I take it positively. And, you know, we've all seen those microaggressions when people say things that are slightly odd, slightly weird, slightly offensive, but it came from a good place. So we think, "Oh yeah, whatever, it's fine." We smile and we carry on. So my personal way of dealing with it is thinking, if it's coming from a good place, then it's positive. Let's keep things moving.
I think you can tell. Yeah, I can tell what is driving someone's comments. I think that is what you've learned. I'm 53, over 53 years of experiencing racism. Because someone can give you a compliment that's actually an insult. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, so I think you know the context of when someone's saying it most of the time, not all of the time.
Yeah, that's a good one, actually. I think you learn over time. But the truth about it is, and this is interesting, because I never used to speak up. And when I've had like racist encounters, I would never report it, I would never talk about it. And going back to burnout, If someone keeps hitting you, eventually it's just going to be too much. And if you don't talk about it, you don't have to make a big song and dance about it, but you need to either talk how you feel safe to talk about it. So find someone who you feel safe to talk about it, or report it if that's your choice. But sometimes what you find is if you report it and you just don't have the mental space to deal with the whole process that goes with it. But for your own well-being, you need to find somewhere safe to talk about it, whether it's a colleague or someone you trust, also a family member, just to sort of like just let it out, you know, just so that you don't carry that on with you. And because all those little microaggressive episodes, the slightly racist, you know, tone of something, you take it in, it's not going to go away. You might not talk about it at that moment in time, but it's not going to go away. So you need to find your own way of dealing with it, but don't take it on and leave that shame on that other person. And it's interesting because I'm part of the Intensive Care Society EDI working group. And so it's an amazing group. It's an honor to be working with them. And one of the things that I've learned is, how do you respond to misogyny, racist, homophobia? It's the same way. You put that shame back on the person. And someone mentioned about, oh, you know, she was in theatre and, you know, something dropped on the floor and she picked it up. And the surgeon made a very horrible comment. And she said, can you explain that a bit more? And he was like, you know. She's like, no, I don't know. Explain it a bit more. Another time, another colleague, someone I'd worked with who's also quite big in EDI space, said, you know, someone made a homophobic comment, and he said, can you explain that a bit more? Because I really don't understand what you're talking about. So then they can't say anything. And that's one of the strategies, is that does two things. One, it puts that shame back on the person, but two, you don't take it in. Mm. And to be honest, that will take time. I'm not sure that all of us on day one will be able to be in that position and tell that person to explain themselves, because you don't know what they're talking about. But in time, if you see, I've heard that story two or three times now, so I feel empowered to do it if it happens. And the whole idea is, if we keep talking about these strategies, practical strategies, but also allow people to be themselves and say, you know what, right now I'm not ready for that. But let them understand that they need to have an outlet that's safe to talk about it, whether it's your husband, your wife, or a friend, or girlfriend, or, you know, a therapist, a counsellor, someone else. You know, pick up the phone, call the BMA.
Wouldn't you say that, so a great majority of these incidences are not reported and no one will speak out. So in terms of giving people tools of what to do, if someone from a different ethnic background or gender, whatever it is, comes to you and raises a concern, that has taken a huge amount of bravery and decision to come to that. So anyone listening to that, that person is coming to you and probably wants action. And I think a lot of the time when people don't speak up, is because they see no action. They see nothing as a consequence of what they have said. And it's really hard, isn't it? And that's why I was talking about the hypervisibility and invisibility. That I got a message from a consultant who will be nameless, who said, I found it really interesting. I've been a consultant for 10 years and I have kept myself hidden. I've got through that by just keeping my head down. And now I think I'm ready to be seen. So I think that's where we're at now. I think in the journey is that we're speaking about this. We're now, the Royal College has got us here and they're listening to us. So now we need to move that on.
That's interesting, because I was talking to Daniel during the lunch break and he raised a really interesting point that I think I've forgotten, if you like, is that certain things that I would say to respond to people, I can say because I'm a consultant. Whereas for him, he's a trainee and he won't feel empowered to say it. And I was like, that's actually really true. And it's not something that I'm conscious of anymore, because I just say what's on my mind now. I can respond to things without, you know, feeling any, you know, oh, I'm too junior to say that. So how do you get someone who's more junior maybe to challenge someone who's senior that's, you know, putting some kind of microaggression on them? I don't even know how to answer that, because I can only answer from myself as a consultant. How do you, as a junior, challenge someone who's been, you know, racist to you in whether it's a covert or overt way, and they're also more senior to you in your organisation?
Sad thing is I'm not sure that we're there yet. Mm. I don't think that the hierarchy and the way that we work, speaking out as a trainee, you've got MSFs, you've got MTRs, you've got ARCPs. You've got all of these things, which is where, as we know the data, this is where people leave their training journey. This is where people encounter adverse outcomes or ARCP. So I don't know how to answer that question, because I think saying something like that puts you in a very difficult and vulnerable position. And the only way to get through that is if you have got someone that will literally carry you through that and protect you. And those people do exist somewhere, but there's probably not enough of those.
I think it's actually quite good to talk about this because from my personal experience, I remember having two or three consultants come up to me and say, we will support you if you do this. And I was like, no, I don't think I can. I'm coming back here. I don't want any problems. Mm-hmm. You know, and two things came out of that. One is that I felt supported. And I felt really supported in that department. And the second thing is I felt heard as well. But also they respected the fact that I wasn't ready. And I think it's good, whilst we're talking about, you know, how do you deal with this, is how do you not feel guilty that you're not dealing with it? Because you have to be mentally ready to take on that load, because it's not easy. It's not the norm, you know, and we're just starting our journey. So it's interesting because someone else said something that you could do. And I was like, I don't know if I would, which was, if someone said something that was, you know, racist, homophobic, misogynistic to you, you could say, are you okay? Because this is really not unlike you, you know. Are you sure you're okay? You know, doctor, whatever, are you okay? Is everything okay? That's very unlike you to say such a thing.
I think these instances come at a time when you least expect them, don't, so they take you off guard, so you don't have, you have all these great things that you can say.
Yeah.
Rats, I missed the opportunity again to say that.
Right, it's something that I think I have to definitely give more thought to when I'm advising trainees or junior doctors how to deal with racism, microaggression at work. I definitely am challenged to think more about how they can deal with it from their perspective, because I think looking back when I was a trainee, I also probably wouldn't have had the confidence to say some of the things that I say now freely.
You don't want to be seen as a troublemaker. You know, because the truth about it is departments are just, you know, everyone's got their struggles. And I think this is one of the things that people need to look at. We're here talking about race and ethnicity. But if we all sit down and think about it, what advantages do I have and what, you know, disadvantages do I have? So me, Sakina, sitting here right now, my parents went to university. My great-grandfather went to university. You know, my kids have a mom who's a doctor and a dad who's, you know, an engineer. They just live their life. I mean, I think I struggle more than they did. They live in a world where they can express themselves in a way that I wasn't able to express myself. You think about all these little things. And so when I think about, in terms of my sexuality, I don't face any prejudice because of my sexuality. I don't have any, you know, disabilities that are visible that would put me at a disadvantage. So I think about all the things in my life that I have that means that life is not as difficult as it could be. And then you look at me, I'm a woman and I'm also black and I'm a Muslim. And those are things that make my day-to-day living slightly more difficult. Now, if you sit down, if everyone sat down and thought about it, there is probably one thing that makes your day-to-day life not as easy as it could be if you didn't have that. We all have that one thing, and even if you don't have it, because you know you were lucky enough not to have it, you will know someone who has it, who you care about. And if you can think about, okay, how can I make this world slightly better for that person who I care about and who I love? And if you look at everybody else with those glasses, then it's slightly easier. So you don't think this is not a me problem. It probably is affecting you, but you haven't really thought about it. And when you start to look at things that way, you stop thinking of people who are talking about their disadvantage because of their race, their sexuality, their disability. You stop thinking of them as troublemakers. You think, okay, you know what? I'm not going to park in front of a drop curb because that's just not fair. This piece of, you know, material that we're giving to people for exam, you know, I'm going to try and make this a bit less wordy. What are the other ways I can present this data so that everyone will feel included? I'm not going to organise all the social events at 7 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the evening in a pub because that excludes parents, a whole bunch of people, or, you know, you start to think a bit wider and then you give people options. And then all of a sudden you realise that people would rather have a barbecue on a Saturday when the sun is out than always going to a dingy pub around the corner that's overpriced. And the world opens up. And the next thing we know is that the staff room is much nicer and, you know, we start doing things that everyone likes. You're like, why didn't we never hire out this restaurant that has a lovely bit? And, you know, why did we always go there? You start to bring out options for people. I remember when you could bring babies to conferences. That was a big deal. I remember when there was in the college, there was a room for people to come and have their babies in and they could stream the conference. And now we can do it from home. Now you have kids walking in while people are doing their presentations. And people start to feel included, that, okay, I can be a mum and do this at I can hold this leadership level. It's just completely revolutionized the way we look at things. And you start to include people, and people start to feel like they are part of something bigger than just their little DGH in sent elsewhere. So we're coming to the end of the podcast, and I was just hoping if you guys would be able to just share one thing you'd like listeners to take away from the podcast today, and perhaps, you know, what they could do.
Yeah, so I echo everyone's thoughts here. It's been amazing. It's been a great session and a great podcast, and it was really well received, which I'm grateful for. And the one thing I would say, I hope listeners take away, especially non-black listeners, is that it's not enough to not be racist. You have to be anti-racist. You have to speak up if you see something happening, even if you don't feel you can speak up in the moment, you know, at least showing that you understand to someone who's black, who's maybe you've seen something they've gone through. It does really go a long way to help and to show that you care, and because you, that person will feel they're not alone. So I think that's something that people can take away as listeners from this.
I think something to take away is that this is a very positive conversation. This is a good conversation, and this is a conversation of progress, that we should be proud of ourselves that we're having this conversation.
Whenever I speak about these sorts of issues, I do find it uncomfortable, because I find it uncomfortable talking about it and being open. But I also know that it's uncomfortable for people listening to things, and it can create actually quite a visceral reaction in the person hearing it, or a defensive reaction, or an emotive reaction, whatever it is. But I think in order for us to progress, there's that phrase about getting comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. So we just need to do that. And then we need to go one step further and decide, okay, what am I actually going to do? So act.
Wow, I think you guys have basically summed up this podcast beautifully. So be anti-racist. It's a good conversation to be having. This is progress. And as Anistis, we lead and everyone follows. So this is, you know, something that we should be proud of that we're doing. And finally, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. If you're not uncomfortable, there can't be progress. We know that, you know, it's the person who comes into the department and shakes things up that makes us get, you know, the things we want. You know, that's when the coffee machine appears and the nice sofas come in. So on a more serious note, we need to be uncomfortable for progress to happen. So thank you everyone for having us today. Thank you College for hosting this podcast, and thank you Desire, Danielle and Sathina for joining me today.
The RCOA warmly welcomes members from across the globe. So if you are based outside of the UK, we invite you to discover the array of benefits available to you as an RCOA international affiliate. To learn more about joining and to explore the benefits of membership, visit rcoa.ac.uk/international-affiliate or click on the link in the show notes.